Thank you for joining me, JT Townsend, my guest, as we talk about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and the murder. We've been talking about all the strange twists and turns regarding this case, and this last hour is going to go by quick. We'll take your calls here around the bottom of the hour. If you have questions and thoughts for our guest, we'll continue to work those in as well. If you want to email them to me, dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com. JT, before the break, I'm sorry. I've been reading emails and following the questions. There was a point you wanted to come back to. Where do you want to start with this segment?
Well, we've got Hauptmann convicted and sentenced to death.
Right. What was the deal that they had with him then? That I think was where we're going to go.
People are just not satisfied with this conviction. I thought we had a kidnap gang. You're telling me this one guy, this carpenter, did this whole thing? All the way up to the governor of New Jersey, people are, this doesn't make sense that this guy could have pulled this off. So Governor Harold Hoffman goes to visit Richard Hauptmann in the death house, and he offers him a deal. Confess to something. Confess to anything. Blame the dead guy. Give us something. I will commute your sentence to life in prison. You will have unlimited visitation with your wife and son. And simultaneous to that, some publication, possibly the New York Times, offered Hauptmann $100,000 for his confession, which would go to his wife and son. When Governor Hoffman makes this deal, Richard Hauptmann breaks down and starts to cry. "I have nothing to confess," he said. He doesn't take this deal, and he goes to the electric chair in April of 1936, and the prosecutors and Schwarzkopf and the police all said, "When we strap him in that chair, he will talk." And Hauptmann comes in, sits down in the electric chair, is asked for his last statement, says nothing, and dies. And there you have it. Justice is done, right?
Well, probably not.
Why wouldn't he take that deal?
Right. Why not try to alleviate it unless he was dealing with some form of guilt on this case?
Well, if you're innocent and you're alive, you've got a chance to clear your name.
Right.
If this is honor among thieves and he doesn't want to name his confederates, okay, maybe. But hey, they're all free, and you're getting ready to sit in the hot seat. What do you have to lose at this point? Governor Hoffman was very impressed with Hauptmann's sincerity, saying, "I have nothing to confess." And he went to his death silent. He made a statement an hour before his electrocution, which I use at the close of my programs. And he said specifically, I have it right here, wanted to read it. I'm just fumbling for that, aren't I?
Well, I'll tell you, we'll come back. You can give us that statement when we return. And I'd also like to talk about a few of the other little connections that were involved in here. There was also rumbling that Ann Morrow, her sister, may have somehow been involved with this. I'm wondering what you might be able to tell us about that, Ann Morrow being the wife of Lindbergh. Let's hear about that. Let's hear about Charles Lindbergh's connection and more when we return here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. This is Coast to Coast AM. JT Townsend, my guest. JT, did you find the quote from Hauptmann there?
I did indeed.
Okay.
"You think when I die, it will be like a book I close, but the book, it will never close." That's basically his last statement. That was an hour before his electrocution. And, you know, his wife worked tirelessly until her death in 1994 to clear her husband's name. And at one point on live television, threw down the gauntlet to Ann Morrow Lindbergh to the effect that, "Please tell what you know about this crime so I can have some peace." So, you know, it's rare you find a case where you've got a guy convicted and executed that's as much a mystery as this crime is.
What is the point with Ann Morrow's sister somehow being involved in this crime?
Well, that's an interesting theory. I think there's an entire book written about it. You know, when Charles Lindbergh was the eligible bachelor, the hero, he met Dwight Morrow and his three daughters, and he initially courted Elizabeth Morrow, the eldest daughter, but he kind of dumped her for Anne. And some people say Elizabeth Morrow never really recovered from that. She was known to be at the Hopewell House over the weekend right before the kidnapping. The theory is, in a jealous rage, she might have killed the child, and this would have been covered up by Lindbergh and his wife, because if his sister-in-law had indeed killed his son, he was not going to let the world know that. No way. And thus the kidnapping was, fabricated. I think the thing I tell people during my talks, Dave, for 85 years, we've been looking for a kidnapper in this case when we should have been looking for a baby killer, someone that could crack this child's skull in the crib or outside the crib. And it's all been cloaked under the guise of a kidnapping. This is a child killing. That's what we're looking at here. So
that kind of begs an interesting part of the question here. Hauptmann's put to death, and you said earlier that, what was it, a few years after his death, suddenly they're interested in reopening the case in a reinvestigation.
Actually, that was while he was still alive.
That was while he was still alive.
That's when Governor Hoffman reopened the investigation, which prompted Lindbergh to put his wife and new son on a freighter in the dead of night and sail to Europe.
Well, what was the cause of the reinvestigation post-conviction there? Why would they do that?
Just the fact that they had no credible evidence whatsoever to place Hauptmann near the home in Hopewell, New Jersey, when the baby was kidnapped. There's really nothing to place him there. He worked that day in New York, and every Tuesday night, he picked his wife up at the bakery she worked at. And on our night in question, no less than four witnesses placed Hauptmann at this bakery in the Bronx, 2 hours away, at the time of the kidnapping, including his own wife. And it's interesting, Dave, his wife would not lie for him. They asked her during the trial, it would really help your husband if you said that he told you about finding the money in the closet. And she said, I'm not going to lie for him. He did not tell me about the money. But she swore he picked her up that night, on Tuesday night, like he did every Tuesday night, and several other people at that bakery placed him there, and they all testified at the trial.
You know, you brought up earlier about the...
believed.
You brought up earlier about the profiler who made the case for who this killer would be.
Uh-huh.
And I talked about the fact that profilers are often wrong. And in perfect example of this, John Douglas did a special for Nova all about this case and even looked at the fact that Lindbergh might have been involved in this and trying to tie it to a few other people. And here you've got John Douglas, one of the premier profilers out there, and he's getting this case wrong, it would appear, still.
Yeah.
And, he's not here to defend himself, but I'm just stating that, you know, it would appear that there's a lot of evidence that we've talked about tonight that wasn't even covered in that Nova special.
Not really. Elizabeth Morrow, just to finish that up.
Right.
She was sent to a European sanitarium during the trial, actually during the lead up to the trial, and she returned to this country in 1934, as Hauptmann was going on trial. And I'm looking at pictures of her right now. Her appearance had changed markedly. And she died in December 1934 at age 35 of heart failure. And people that knew her said she never recovered from the death of her nephew. So she basically died prematurely. And we can place her at the crime scene on the weekend before the crime. So one scenario, one of the inside scenarios does involve her, without question. But, yeah, profiling, hard to say how it fits in this crime.
Right. I'm just showing that even profilers can get this type of thing wrong, and if they go into it with their own preconceived notion, they can shape it to follow their theory on how this goes. The child's skull being cracked, it had a hole puncture in one side and then a fracture along the other. There was theorization that one of the policemen, when they first found the body and moving it, inadvertently poked a hole through the skull.
That's actually true. They were moving the body with a stick,
right,
and they poked a little hole. But there was a skull fracture, either consistent with a blow to the child's head or possibly a fall from the ladder,
right,
a rickety ladder that suddenly has 40 more pounds on it. I don't think the child went down that ladder at all. I think that child went out the front door. If I could for just a minute, because
yes,
my wife and I toured that home in 2013. It's now a government home for at-risk New Jersey youth. We got a three-hour tour, and we hadn't been there more than 45 minutes, and my wife nudged me and whispered in my ear, "Inside job." The house has been often described as spacious and rambling. It is not. It's built on a very small scale, small rooms, narrow hallways, lots of closets, lots of doors, sound travels. The front foyer is the size of a walk-in closet, and there are no sight lines on the first floor to see anyone coming in and out of that front door. And for my money, that child was taken out the front door. I think the ladder, to some extent, was a ruse. But when you walk through that house, the idea of this as an inside job really starts to kind of take hold, because it's so remote. One of the counselors told me, you know, at night it's really dark here because there's nothing around. He said, imagine in 1932 how dark it was, and how could a kidnapped gang come up here, figure out which room the baby was in? And I probably didn't mention, Dave, there was one room or one window in the nursery with a broken lock of the three, and that's the window they supposedly came in. Now, I'm not sure how kidnappers would know that that window had the broken lock either.
Right.
But you walk through this house, and it just strikes you that how could somebody have taken this child without anybody hearing anything? Anne Morrow Lindbergh's bathroom opens onto the nursery. Betty Gow's bathroom is right next door to the nursery, and both women, between the hours of 8 and 10, were in and out of their bathrooms with nothing more than a closed door separating them from the nursery. Nobody heard anything from that room. Nothing. And you had people very close by. You know, I've stood in those rooms,
mm-hmm,
and with the door closed, and had my wife and the tour guide make noise in the nursery like they were clumping across the floor. You can hear everything. But no one heard anything that night.
Well, you brought up earlier that if you're this group, why would you go in while everyone was awake and doing this? Wouldn't that be the perfect time to do a crime like this? Because if you do it in the middle of the night when it's quiet and dead quiet, you have a better chance of being heard, and footsteps would definitely seem out of the ordinary at that time. If you were able to get in while the house was live and there was people moving about and talking and laughing or moving about, that might kind of cloak some of your activity.
You would think, Dave, but having been in that house, no, I would have gone in the dead of night.
Okay.
You got the watchdog, you got the women in the bathrooms that basically adjoin the nursery that are very close. I would have gone in the dead of night and got a head start, because the child wouldn't have been found missing till the morning. And again, how does this kidnap gang get this intel that the family's even there? And what room the child is in, and what window has the
Let's start to point that finger now. I mean, we're coming into the end game here for us, and we've got a lot of callers starting to build up. Why Lindbergh? What would Charles Lindbergh gain from the abduction and subsequent murder of his own child?
Well, let's look at the other two scenarios that interest me. The Elizabeth Morrow scenario is one of them. He would have covered up his sister-in-law's involvement in the death of that child. So that's legitimate to me. He never would have publicized that. And there's a guy wrote an entire book about that theory. The other two theories, the child was indeed defective, retarded, mentally challenged. Perhaps Lindbergh set up a kidnapping to take the child to an institution. The child was killed during the kidnapping, or the child was actually sent to an institution and the body in the woods was someone else. Those are viable theories there.
Right. There is a belief, too, that body, there was a children's pauper's grave not too far from there.
There was an orphanage nearby.
Right.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Boy, Dave, you've done your homework.
I try. It happens on occasion.
You know, Dave, I stood in the woods where this body was found. And it's exactly halfway between the Hopewell house and the farmhouse Lindbergh stayed in during the construction. It's exactly at the halfway point. And there's nothing along that road. In darkness, I can't imagine a kidnapped gang actually going south to dump that body. So the third theory is this one. And there's an entire book about this theory called Crime of the Century, by Gregory Algren and Stefan Monnier, the only two law enforcement people to actually write about this case. They postulate that this was a Lindbergh practical joke gone awry, and that he implemented this kidnapping to cover up the fact that he tried to take his child down a ladder and killed it. And if anybody would have gone down that ladder, it would be a daring wing walker like Lindbergh. And let me, if I may, very quickly, because I made some notes, tell you about the forgotten witness.
All right, we've got about 2 minutes in this segment, but go ahead.
I tell you what, I can do this real quick. A 19-year-old Princeton University student named Ben Lupica, he was a Lindbergh neighbor. The night of the kidnapping, about 7 o'clock, I have stood right where he stood on that road. He's getting his mail. He sees a green car with New Jersey license plate and a three sections of a ladder on top of the car, pull around the corner near the Lindbergh driveway. The driver of the car sees Lupica and stops. And Lupica said the guy had New Jersey license plates, had a ladder on his car. He testified at trial that it was definitely not Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And everyone's forgotten about this guy. So he saw someone with a New Jersey license plate, a green car, and a kidnap and a ladder about an hour before the kidnapping. And he identified this person as not Hauptmann and not Hauptmann's car. But everybody's kind of forgotten about him. And they interviewed him in the 1990s in this book, and he said, "I was taken to the house the day after the kidnapping, introduced to Lindbergh, and they said, 'Colonel, this is the young student who saw the car with the kidnap ladder.' And Lupica said Lindbergh could not get away from him fast enough, did not want to speak to him, immediately turned and left. And the theory is that was Lindbergh in that car getting ready to set up his practical joke. Because the guy was a practical joker like you wouldn't believe. And yet, after the death of his son, according to his biographers, he never committed another practical joke."
JT Townsend, our guest, as we continue to wrap up with the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and murder. We'll take your calls when we return. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you so much for joining me, and if you are as fascinated by true crime as I am, please check out my website at darknessradio.com. You can follow our show, Beyond the Darkness, and our new Edition True Crime Tuesday. Just click on the banner. You can find out how to subscribe for True Crime Tuesday. And I want to thank George Norrie and Lisa Lyon, of course, for allowing me this format to come on and share these stories with you. I love doing this, and they're always so open with the guest ideas I bring on. JT Townsend, our guest tonight, as we talk about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. George has a night off. And again, if you want to find out where you can meet George or see him interact with George, then check out coasttocoastam.com. He's got a great program coming up Saturday, July 29th. It's 5 to 8 p.m. at the Everett Theater in Everett, Washington. You get a chance to see a live stage show with the Emmy Award-winning host of this show, Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie will interview some of today's brightest experts in the field of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. It's a three-hour stage show that consists of interviews combined with video, music, singing, and more, which create a very unforgettable experience for theater goers and fans of Coast to Coast AM. You can find information by just visiting coasttocoastam.com and click on the George tab. You'll find all of his information. And make sure you keep up with his TV show. That's a fantastic program as well. It's something that I absolutely love watching. And I love listening to Coast to Coast. It's been a part of my world now for over 20 years. And there are times when you're listening to these guests and you can almost see what they're talking about. This is your chance to actually see it with Beyond Belief. And every month, he's got new episodes coming out. There's seven seasons of this, over 259 episodes. They're going to be talking about Nostradamus and predictions in the next episode coming up this next week. So go check out beyondbelief.com. And remember, become a Coast Insider and never miss another minute of great radio and overnight talk radio like this. It's 15 cents a day for a one-year subscription, and you get access to all of these fantastic episodes, all the great guest hosts, and George Norrie, of course, all of the fantastic guests you hear. You'll never miss another minute of the best in overnight talk radio. When we return, JT Townsend will start with your calls here on Coast to Coast AM. JT Townsend wraps up the series here with me as we continue talking about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. JT, if our listeners are interested in picking up your books and following you, what is the best way to do that?
Well, books are on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. If there's any bookstores left out there, they're probably carrying them. I think you guys noted my website. I've also got a fascinating Facebook page, JT Townsend, True Crime Detective. Got a lot of little short pieces on that that are good. And, you know, I like to read anthologies about crimes in other cities, New York, San Francisco, Chicago. Cincinnati's got some strange cases in my two books. So I would highly recommend them.
Right. We just covered the unknown legend of the Cincinnati Strangler on our True Crime Tuesday this last week. It was fascinating. Get the books. Follow with this man. All right, JT, do you mind? Let's grab some phone calls here.
Sure, let's do it.
Let's go wild card. Line one, Wayne in Chicago. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, gentlemen. Absolutely fascinating. And this is the first time I ever heard Parliament on Coast to Coast. So you go, Dave.
I got to give credit where credit's due. That's my great producers this evening, Michael and Nathan.
I heard Flashlight by Parliament myself, yes.
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Townsend.
Yes.
Okay, I have just a couple of questions real quickly. What's his name? Lindbergh's sister-in-law. She was there the weekend before the child disappeared. Can you place her the actual weekend the child disappeared? Where was she? Then I have one more question after that.
Well, she was there on a Saturday and Sunday. And was actually alone with the child, I'm told, for maybe up to 90 minutes. Now, the child didn't officially disappear until Tuesday night.
Okay, was she still there Tuesday night?
No, she was not.
Okay.
She had accidentally or on purpose killed that child during the weekend. That could be why Lindbergh blew off that talk and came home on a Tuesday night to set this kidnap ruse in motion.
Right. You know what? When the college students saw the man in the car with the ladder,
Absolutely.
If Lindbergh, if he really wanted to find out what happened to his kid, the first thing he would have been doing was talking to that college kid. So that tells you right there, Lindbergh knew exactly what happened. My theory is possibly that the baby was deformed, his baby. He believed in that Nazi Aryan race superiority. You said
he sure did.
I was Goering,
yep.
Who Hitler used to call a pig behind his back. And then when he took that cyanide capsule before they hung Goering, his body turned green, his jailer said. That's just a side note. But anyway, you know, that may be the reason why he got rid of his baby, because it was deformed. It didn't fit the Aryan race superiority thing. Or either it was his sister-in-law, one of the two. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much calling in, Wayne. Let's go east of the Rockies. Barry in South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hello there, Dave.
Hello.
You, this is absolutely the most fascinating show I think I've ever heard on Coast to Coast. And the previous caller, I think he's very close to what happened. And I'm 74 years old, Dave, and I've never even heard about this conspiracy. I can't believe it, because I'm a fairly read person, and I haven't kept up with it. But I thought Lindbergh was a hero, and now I think he's subject to murder or conspiracy to murder.
If I could jump in there real quick. He was not a nice man. Charles Lindbergh was not a nice man at all.
Yeah, I would say that at least.
Very suspicious of him.
Thank you, Barry. Yeah, he was. He definitely was in the eugenics aspect of it. He was a Nazi sympathizer, according to a lot of the stories of racist.
He was not a nice guy, any way, shape, or form. Despite being a hero, not a good man.
Let's go to wild card line two. Annie in Alabama, you're on the air. Annie, are you with us?
Oh, Annie.
Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? It's a little Michael Jackson for you. All right, let's go wild card line three. Richard in Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Hi, Dave. How are you guys?
Doing good, Richard. What's your question this evening?
Well, I was curious about whether or not the lock was broken. Could they tell the lock was broken from the inside or outside? And then there was something about the nurse.
Oh, you're talking about the window where the nursery was. One of the windows had a broken lock. You're wondering if they could tell from the outside or if it could only be told from the inside.
It was actually a shutter lock. It was not readily apparent. Every window in that house was locked up tight, except the window that the kidnapper allegedly came in. That was the only open window that anyone could have come in that night, and that happened to be in the nursery. And how would that kidnapper know that? And the note was placed on the windowsill. I would leave it in the crib if I'm taking that child. But it's interesting that neither Ann Moore or Betty Gow saw that note when the initial alarm went out. It was only after Lindbergh returned to the nursery. He's the one that found the note.
Sharon,
that really bothers me. They would have found that note right away.
Right. But Sharon writes in and she says, who was Jaffe and what was the significance of interlocking rings with square inside the rings?
Good point. Jaffe is the initials for John Condon. That was his code name for the kidnappers, Jaffe. And the original ransom note had three interlocking circles. It looked like a gun sight, and it said, you will know us by these interlocking circles. And every subsequent ransom note did have those. But let's not forget, that ransom note was circulated all through New York City, a copy of it. And only after that circulation did other ransom notes show up. I mean, that was Lindbergh's directive to do that. Got to be the stupidest thing I've ever seen in true crime history. Let's put the main piece of evidence out there. You don't think every crackpot in the world was going to try to collect that $50,000?
Right.
Wow. Yeah.
All right.
Jaffe was Condon. And the three circles was the supposedly the identification of the kidnappers.
Let's go to wild card line four, Roy in Summerfield, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Thank you, Dave and JT. The first caller, Wayne, has one of my ideas. I think Lindbergh accomplished several purposes by staging the kidnapping of Charlie Jr. and then murdering his son. One, he got rid of an embarrassment, like Wayne said, contrary to Nazi eugenics. But two, this is something another Nazi did. He gained a lot of sympathy, public sympathy, and probably a lot of money. Could be anonymous cash donations that were never reported. There was someone in the Kennedy killing, Edwin A. Walker. He garnered sympathy by just being shot at. It wasn't even known if he was in the room. I wonder, JT, if you think Lindbergh got a lot of money from this.
You know, not that I'm aware of. It's interesting that the $50,000 that was passed in the cemetery was the bank's money. It was not Lindbergh's money. And when Lindbergh was asked to put up another $50,000 after the botched initial attempt, he refused because it was going to be his own money. So that's kind of interesting. Mm. I think he was pretty well fixed. He certainly got a lot of sympathy. I'm not sure about the money that he might have gotten. That's an interesting point.
Let's go first-time caller line. We've got John in West Virginia. Welcome to the line. John, are you with us? No. Oh, Andy. I'm sorry, Andy. All right, you're on the line. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dave. How are you?
Good. Sorry about that. Welcome to the show.
Oh, no, nothing to be sorry for. Dave, Mr. Townsend, is it?
Yes.
I was director of the Hunterdon Historical Museum, and I was responsible for helping to save the jail in which Richard Halpin was kept. In the courthouse, I probably read 2,000 pages of testimony, and or 2,000 pages of information. And I grew up in Morris, Somerset, and Hunterdon County, and this over the last half century, this was a huge issue. And Mr. Townsend, I have to tell you, your information is excellent, and I have been to the kidnap window many times, and I know.
Oh, have you been inside the house?
Once, yes. The point being, I really have to point out, and the fact of the matter is, the whole you were talking about Condon, and that whole thing is just too weird for words. But and I don't think we're ever going to solve this case. But what I will say is, my information was that Colonel Lindbergh, who I think is, he's a weird guy. There's no question about it.
Oh, yeah.
But he comes home at about 8:30, and he goes and bathes, and they have a fire going in the fireplace there. And he and Ann Morrow sit on the couch after eating, and they hear a crash at about, 9:30, something like that. It's after Betty Gow has put the baby to sleep. And I really... the ladder was broken, Mr. Townsend, so it's entirely possible that whoever was kidnapping the child, this was the story I heard for 50 years, that the child was dropped. That the child literally
possible.
Fell out of the kidnappers.
Let me correct you, though. Lindbergh said he heard a snapping sound outside. It was a little earlier than 9:30. Ann Morrow did not hear it, nor did anyone else in the house, and the dog did not bark. The sound of the snapping originated with Lindbergh and rests with him. Certainly, that child could have fallen from that ladder. It's possible. I'll tell you this. trying to back out onto that ladder from that window, carrying a 40-pound child on a windy night. The U.S. Army tried to duplicate that during the daytime with a similar ladder. It was just virtually physically impossible for someone to actually back onto that ladder from that window, based on the construction of that ladder, to actually physically get yourself out and onto it. And not to mention closing the window and leaving the ransom note while you're holding the child. Physically, it just didn't seem possible that someone could have done that. Now, someone could have handed that child to someone on the ladder. That makes more sense, because let's remember, there are no muddy footprints on that floor. And I'm looking at a picture right now of that yard. It was an absolute quagmire. There was just nothing but mud. No grass has been planted yet. And yet, other than a couple smudges on the crib, there is no mud or dirt in that room. And that windowsill, there are objects in that windowsill that were not disturbed at all. So
fascinating. Yeah.
We've been sold this story that this was a kidnapping. But this all originated from Charles Lindbergh with his very first pronouncement, "And they have stolen our baby." And he put himself in charge of this investigation, and it seemed like everything he tried to do was obscuring the trail and creating false leads away from New Jersey. Everything he did seemed to create deceptive clues to mislead the police.
Let's grab wildcard line 5, Daniel in Central Texas. Real quick question for our guest.
I didn't really have a question. I just wanted to kind of point something out. When I was in my youth, it's kind of embarrassing, but when I was in my youth, I used to burglarize homes. And one of the things that we did was we went in when people were home because their guard is down and it's easier than you think to move around in someone's home while they are home and awake and get in and get out without them knowing that you were there. I also wanted to point out that it's a possibility that someone entered the home, put a ladder up, entered the home, came in, stole the child, and left out the window. And didn't come in that way, but that's how they went out.
And it's more likely that they might have come in the window, but not gone out that way. If indeed there was a kidnapper that came up that ladder. I mean, the ladder might be the biggest red herring of the whole case, possibly. But, most burglars still want to come in when people aren't there, for the most part.
Thank you very much for calling in. Right. What a fascinating twisted tale all the way around. I mean, it's heartbreaking that this death took place. And, but it just goes to show you there's, people in power and famous people are not above crime and above making bad choices, and we've continued to see that.
Minute here.
You have about 20 seconds, unfortunately.
20 seconds.
Yep.
The FBI studied 1,700 kidnappings for ransom in the 1990s, and in only one case was the victim found murdered in their own home, and that was JonBenet Ramsey. Think about the statistical aberration of that.
Thank you so much for your insights, all the information. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you to all the Coast listeners for being a part of the show tonight. And I also want to thank Michael and Nathan back at home office, Donna for fielding our calls, Gabe Anderson, my engineer here at KNSI, Chris Boros and Amy Rouse, my producers for the show, Lisa Lyon, and of course, George Norrie, and my guests, Greg Lawson and JT Townsend. I'll be back with you at the end of May, the last Friday and Saturday. Until then, be kind, be nice, love one another, and I'll see you then right here on Coast to Coast AM.